Esther is a beautifully written short story. The main characters are Esther, a beautiful young Jewish girl, and Mordecai, her older cousin who raises her and is like a father to her. They are exiles in the Persian Empire, and it's about 500 years before the time of Christ. And like so often in Jewish history, Esther and her people are in danger. There are powerful people in the Persian government who want to kill Esther and all her people, which reminds us so vividly of the 20th century and the Holocaust. Esther, like Mary, the mother of Jesus, is plucked from obscurity to perform an extraordinary role. It's a life-threatening role, and if she fails, not only will Esther die, but Mordecai and all their people will die as well. Before we meet Esther and Mordecai in chapter 2, we first meet two other people who set the story in motion: Xerxes, king of Persia, and his wife, Queen Vashti. Chapter 1 will set the scene for us as we get a glimpse of life in the royal palace. Xerxes and Vashti are about to have a family crisis, which will have surprising repercussions for Esther, Mordecai, and all the Jewish family. Section 1. Banquets and booze in the palace of Susa, verses 1 to 8. The story begins with King Xerxes in party mode. He's hosting a vast banquet for all his nobles, princes, and military leaders. It says that this banquet went on for 6 months, if you can believe it. And during this banquet, look at verse 4, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. The glitterati of the Persian Empire are here to party at the king's expense. And if they'd had social media in those days, everyone would have been taking pictures of themselves dining in the palace. At this time in history, the Persians were at war with the Greeks, as is recorded by the ancient historian Herodotus. And we think this six-month banquet is not just a feast, but is also a war council held for Xerxes to rally his troops behind the next military campaign. So Xerxes is wining and dining his key leaders to rally their support, and it's a party with a purpose. And the purpose is to display his power and to rally his troops. So they have that first banquet for 6 months, and then after that, Xerxes hosts a second banquet. This time it's just for a week, and it's for all the people in the citadel of Susa, verse 5. That is, this banquet, the second one, is for the public service, all those who serve the king and live in the palace complex called the citadel. Perhaps the king is using this second banquet to say thank you to all those who worked so hard during the prior 6 months serving at the first banquet. But this second banquet is yet another opportunity for the king to display his splendor, his wealth, and his majesty. Look at how the setting is described. It's in his own private gardens, and the gardens are bedecked with white and blue linen, hanging from silver rings on marble pillars. There are gold and silver couches for the guests to sit on. There are mosaic pavements inlaid with precious stones for the guests to walk on. And there are wine cups of gold to drink from, each cup unique in its design. It's extravagant and ostentatious. And the wine flows freely for 7 days. Each person can drink as much as they want because the bar never closes. It's a bit like one of those exclusive hospitality tents at the Melbourne Cup Birdcage, where the Veuve Clicquot flows non-stop all day. Well, so I'm told. It may be fun for a while, but it can be pretty messy at the end. So imagine what Xerxes and all his guests are like after boozing in his private garden for 7 days. It might not be a pretty sight. All of this gold and marble, food and drink is meant to impress his guests and to impress us, the readers. It certainly impressed Alexander the Great a century or so later when he entered the citadel at Susa as victor. Herodotus records that Alexander found over 1,000 tons of gold and silver bullion and more than 270 tons of gold coins that the Persian kings had accumulated. Xerxes is a wealthy man. He is a powerful man. He's a king, and he rules over this vast empire of 270 provinces stretching from Kush to India. So if Xerxes invites you to a party, it's not really an invitation, it's a command. You come. If he invites you to drink, you drink. This is a man who is used to power, and he is in charge. Now, near the end of the two banquets, Xerxes is pretty pleased with himself, and he's probably pretty drunk. But someone is missing. The royal queen, Queen Vashti. Vashti says no, section 2, verses 9 to 12. Only now do we learn that Vashti has been hosting a party of her own for all the women of the palace, which means that Xerxes' banquets and parties have been men-only affairs, perhaps something between a gentleman's club and a stag party. You get the atmosphere. King Xerxes, high in spirits from wine, commands his private retinue of 7 eunuchs to go and get Queen Vashti. She's to leave the safety of the women's party and join the men in the garden. And look at verse 11. She's to come wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. Now remember, this is a summons, not an invitation. The queen is not equal to the king, as Henry VIII's 6 wives would discover in the 16th century. Vashti is commanded to appear, and the 7 men are sent to bring her into the king's presence. But Vashti simply refuses. Hashtag Vashti says no hits the Persian airwaves like a thunderclap. And the king is outraged. He burns with anger. How can she refuse? Who does she think she is? Now, what's happening here? Why does Vashti refuse? Well, the writer doesn't tell us, so we just have to surmise, and plenty of people have done that in trying to understand the Book of Esther. Over the centuries, some commentators, including Jewish rabbis in the medieval period, they thought that when Xerxes wanted Vashti to appear before the men with her crown on, that what it was saying there is that she was to have her crown on and not much else on. Others have suggested that she may have been drunk herself after hosting a party for 7 days. One writer, looking carefully at dates and particularly at the dates of when children were born, thinks that Vashti was pregnant, and that's why she didn't come. We just don't know. What we do know from the story is that Xerxes likes displaying his wealth and his power. And it's not hard to imagine that he wants to show off his beautiful wife as just another ornament in his palace, like his gold goblets and couches. It may be he's saying to his guests in a rather crude way, I am in charge here. I am in charge of all your lives. Even the queen is at my beck and call. But she causes a problem when she says, no deal, I am not going to appear at your drunken party. So people have wondered about Vashti, and different commentators have come to different conclusions about her. Some commend her. They see her as a really positive role model for women. and commend her for her courage and dignity in standing up to her drunken husband. Feminist interpreter Alice Laffey, for example, says Vashti's refusal is an attack on patriarchy. She's refusing to be the men's sexual object and her husband's toy. She sees Vashti as the unsung heroine of the story, whereas Esther, she criticises, as the stereotypical woman using her beauty to gain success at the expense of Vashti. So some people see Vashti in a very positive light. Others are more critical of Vashti, including Martin Luther, and criticise her for disobeying her husband. They see her as a disobedient wife. So in their eyes, she is the problem, not Xerxes. Female biblical scholar Karen Jobes, however, says that we're missing the point if we focus on sexism or marital relations. Sexism is not the major theme of the book, says Karen, and those who interpret the story through that lens have either missed or ignored the author's major concern with the rescue of God's people from danger. In the end, Vashti's refusal is ambiguous. The author makes no moral or ethical evaluation of her behaviour. More importantly, I think, Xerxes' command to his queen and Vashti's refusal set in motion the chain of events that lead to Esther's surprising coronation as the next queen. We who look with the eyes of faith may be able to see God at work in these decisions of Vashti's and Xerxes, even if they can't see it at the time and they don't realise that God is using their decisions. And so the book of Esther gets us thinking about how we humans make decisions and how God can work through our decisions even if we don't know it at the time and it only becomes clear in hindsight. For example, I would never have met my wife Ginny if she had not made the decision to come to work at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. Had she stayed working in England, we would never have met. And so 31 years later, we look back and can see God at work in our lives. And that's been such an important part, such an important decision for us personally, but also for our children. So sometimes God guides us quite clearly, like Paul on the Damascus Road or Moses at the burning bush. Sometimes it's crystal clear what God wants us to do. Go here, do this, don't do that. At other times, it's less clear. We make our decisions, and it's only with hindsight that we're able to discern God's leading and ordering. Here in the story of Esther, in this first chapter, this is the first, but certainly not the last time, or the last example, where we might discern what we call the hidden hand of God influencing human affairs in such a way as to bring about his purposes. God may be hidden from the story, but he's certainly there. Behind the everyday decisions of human beings, including those of pagan kings and queens, stands the true king. The book of Esther will reaffirm that we would rather have our lives in God's hands than in the hands of any earthly king. Section 3, Crisis in the Empire. Are you serious? Verses 13 to 22. So Xerxes and Vashti have a fallout, and you would think, as mature adults, they could sort it out behind closed doors. But that doesn't seem to be the way in royal families. Again, Henry VIII, when he had trouble with his wife Catherine of Aragon, he let the whole of Europe know that he was having marital problems. More recently, the British royal family, with their unhappy marriages, that is in the media for all of us to see, quite sadly. So Xerxes does the same. He airs his dirty linen in public. His so-called wise men advise him to banish Vashti and to get another queen. So that's the end of Vashti, and in the next chapter, Xerxes will indeed begin the search for her replacement. But, and this is where the story takes a slightly comic twist, the wise men, so-called, and the king decide that not only is this a problem between the king and the queen, but this is now a potential problem for every marriage in the entire empire. If the queen refuses the king, where will it all end? Every wife in Persia might decide to turn against her husband. Look at verses 17 to 18. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands. And there will be no end of disrespect and discord. So in order to prevent this, the men, these powerful men at the palace, decide to send out a royal decree all over the empire, warning the women. Look at what happened to Vashti. So learn your lesson. Don't disobey your husband. And then they proclaim to the husbands, verse 22, that every man should be ruler over his own household. Well, that ought to do the trick in all the Persian lounge rooms and bedrooms. The royal decree says the man's in charge, so he must be. That will keep the women in their place. Well, what a ridiculous overreaction. Now Xerxes' embarrassment has been proclaimed far and wide by his own media, no less. They've taken a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Ironically, it indicates that Vashti may have had more power in the empire than even she realised. You see, if it takes a royal decree to establish that every man is ruler over his own household, just maybe the problem is with the men and not with the women. I think we're meant to laugh at the thought of all those messengers scurrying all over the empire proclaiming such a ridiculous decree. And so the first chapter ends with one queen deposed and a job opening for a new queen. What conclusions can we draw from this opening chapter? Well, first of all, let's agree that this chapter is not a warning against drunkenness, extravagance, or gluttony. Nor is it a warning about marriage relationships. These moral and marital issues appear, but they're here to create the scene and develop the context for the story that is about to occur, the story about God's people. What really matters in chapter 1, I think, is that we're introduced to two kingdoms. One is the Persian kingdom, ruled, dominated, and controlled by Xerxes. It's a kingdom where everyone must kneel to his absolute power. You must come to his banquets. You must be impressed by his wealth. You must fight in his wars. Do what he says, and appear when summoned. There is talk of law and justice, but these are just weapons at the king's disposal to command compliance to his wishes. There is no justice in this kingdom, as Vashti discovers, and everyone is at risk of the king's displeasure. So that's the first kingdom, the kingdom of this world, you might say, the Persian kingdom. The second kingdom is God's kingdom. Now, in Esther, God's kingdom is like the mustard seed of the Gospels, small and seemingly hidden. In God's kingdom, neither power nor people are abused as they are in Persia. God is a great king who rules over all things, but his rule is expressed in love and care and compassion, and his law and justice are blessings. The story of Esther, like so much of the Bible, will bring these two kingdoms into conflict. It's a conflict you know well from other parts of the Bible. Think of Moses in Egypt, Daniel in Babylon, Jesus before Herod, and the beasts, dragons, and antichrists of Revelation. It's what Paul says in Ephesians 6 is a spiritual battle, a battle against the rulers and against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. There is a real battle going on. And in Esther, it is symbolized between as a battle between the Persian kingdom and God's kingdom. Esther and Mordecai, two representatives of God's people, will find themselves in a fight for their lives. They don't know it yet, but they are in real danger, and so are all God's people. What is intriguing is that in this story, unlike in Exodus or Daniel, God is more like an unseen director of events. We know that he's there because he's everywhere, but it's not obvious. And this is the big lesson for us. Every day we live in a world dominated by powers that are ungodly. We face problems, we feel at risk, and every day we look for God to help us, give us direction and protection. Esther reminds us that God's ways are not always obvious, and we might have to wait to see what God is doing. And we live by faith, knowing that God is in charge, not Xerxes or his modern equivalents. It's also useful to remember that the author has had some fun at Xerxes' expense. Esther is a subversive text, poking fun at all empires and anyone who thinks they command the destiny of human beings. Xerxes is certainly powerful, but there is one more powerful than he. And along with King David, we acknowledge who that is when we say in the words of 1 Chronicles 29:11, "Yours, Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the majesty and the splendor, for everything in heaven and earth is yours." Bless you.